This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Thank you once again, American consumers, from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday today. This one is the 15th day of October. Good as always to have you along, everybody. I said what I said in the open, that bit about American consumers, because holy cow, are we carrying a disproportionate load in this economy right now. The September report on retail sales came out this morning, up 0.7% from August, which itself was up 0.9% from July. And we are buying everything. Clothing, home goods, we're going out to bars and restaurants. But I've got some questions, which I will pose to Neela Richardson. She is the chief economist at ADP. Also, Jordan Holman. She covers retail at Bloomberg. Hey, you too.
Hi, Kai. Hey,
so, Neela, let me ask you this. These retail sales numbers are in dollar amounts, right? So inflation, rising prices is a factor in there. But can one safely infer that American consumers aren't too worried about the inflation numbers that we got this week and higher prices?
I think you can. Consumers are spending. The economy has come roaring back in almost a fast and furious way. It's been helped by a lot of government spending along mm-hmm. the way. Mm-hmm. Consumers are in really good shape in terms of the macro level. Household balance sheets are strong. But inflation is the thing in the background. So as much as consumers did well in September in terms of their spending, prices may continue to take a bite out of incomes, which signals a lower retail spending going forward.
Jordan, what do you think? Lower retail spending going forward? How worried are the people you talk to in retail about that?
Yeah, it's really an interesting dynamic because coming forward, like thinking about this month, all the retailers are trying to encourage shoppers to start buying holiday items right now. Mm-hmm. But they are up against inflation. And so far, we haven't seen consumers be too shaken by the higher prices. And so it's a delicate balance. But when you look at sentiment and how concerned they are about future outlook, that's giving us a better picture about what it might look like in terms of people actually opening their wallets.
Well, keep going with that. What does consumer sentiment tell us about what consumers might do?
Yeah, consumer sentiment, it's the lowest, second lowest since 2011. Right. And so it's interesting, like retail sales give us a picture of what happened in the past. Like that is what consumers bought in September, and sentiment gives us a view of the future. And right now, people are concerned about inflation. So even though it hasn't stopped them from buying things now, who's to say that as we get deeper into the season and retailers are not pushing promotions like they have in the past, that people won't just, right, you know, stop spending.
Right. So, Neela, let me riff on that, looking backward, looking forward thing as it applies to the supply chain. We have had port backlogs and supply chain backlogs in this economy for, I don't know, 6, 8, 9 months now. Biden administration this week said, hey, look, we're going to get the Port of Los Angeles to work 24/7. Is that going to be enough?
Well, you really have two moving tides here. You have supply chain bottlenecks caused by the pandemic, mm-hmm. but you also have ongoing labor shortages. And that has been persistent. In fact, the amount of churn in the labor market right now, the number of people quitting their jobs, going to other jobs, the number of clients, customers, businesses reporting the fact that they just can't find qualified workers. It's not just the fact that there's a supply chain issue. It is made worse by the fact that there's a labor issue and we're not seeing workers take jobs in the places they're needed most. You know, we need people to unload the goods mm-hmm. at the ports. We need people to drive them around in truck drivers. We need people to take them from the warehouse and stock shelves. Right now, there's even a shortage of things to put, containers to put supply mm-hmm. in, goods in, to transport it back and forth. So we're low on everything.
I will tell you, I was down at the Port of Long Beach today at a container depot, and there were trucks moving all over the place, but those trucks can only carry one container at a time. So I hear what you're saying. But Neela, let me ask you this, and it's a little bit sideways, but on the labor issue, since I've got you on the phone, labor, it seems, is having a moment right now with the John Deere strike and the potential Hollywood strike, and the Kellogg folks have been on strike now for a week, 10 days. This, it seems to me, I'll be curious to see what you think of this, a workers' economy right now.
Right. It's hard to call it a workers' economy with 5 million people still sidelined by the pandemic. But I see where you're going with this because things have changed. Yeah. Workers have reassessed. And even as we're seeing still some jobs recovery to go, there's a record number of job openings. In fact, at ADP, when we survey our clients, we said that finding qualified workers is the number one challenge facing small businesses. So even in the midst of this ongoing jobs recovery, businesses can't find workers. And that puts a lot of leverage to the workers themselves who have seen some reassessment on what they value, whether they actually want to go back to service jobs in close contact with people or whether they'd rather work virtually. And that's going to be, it's not just about wages, it's about workplace conditions as well.
Right. The great resignation is a thing. Jordan, let me get back to the supply chain for a minute. One of the things that the Biden administration said in its announcement about getting the Port of L.A. to work 24/7 was that it's going to have its retail partners sort of do their bit, right? Walmart mm-hmm. was in there. I think Target might have been. It does take all the gears working together. Neela was talking about truckers and people to unload. It's not just like they can run the port 24/7 and solve this.
Right. It was really interesting to watch the White House basically plea companies and competitors to come together to solve this. Home Depot was also in that. They promised to shift 10% of its containers to off hours. But that's just one issue. Like, that's been the whole story with the supply chain. You try to fix one thing, you have to think about another. All of these issues are compounding on top of one another. And going back to Neela's point about labor, especially for retailers, they'll put out big numbers like, we need to hire 10,000 seasonal workers. But can that, you know, actually be possible? Which would be a really rough situation since demand is expected to be so high going into this holiday season.
Yeah, Neela, go ahead.
If I can pick up on Jordan's point, there's been a reassessment for workers and businesses, but also consumers. The way we mm-hmm. buy and what we buy mm-hmm. has changed. And there's been a massive shift for consumers away from services towards goods, which only amplifies the shortages because now you have a supply bottleneck matched with high consumer demand in the midst of this global recovery. So will consumers start buying services again, or will they stick with stuff? That's the question.
That is the question of many about this economy right now. Neela Richardson, chief economist at ADP. Jordan Holman, she's at Bloomberg. Thanks, you too. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Kai.
On Wall Street today, I mean, look, it was kind of a bumpy week, right? But if you're looking at corporate profits, which basically is what the stock market is, there's a whole lot to like. Also, the bond market has decided, despite the consumer and producer price indexes we talked about this week, that is to say inflation, the bond market has decided it's not a thing. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Okay, let us talk banks here for a minute, shall we? The big Wall Street banks have been reporting quarterly profits this week, and profits have been, well, there have been a lot of them across the board, in part because they've had to set aside less cash to cover loan losses recently than they did earlier in the pandemic. But something that is not happening, actually lending more money. Marketplace's Justin Ho has that one on Wall Street.
There hasn't been a whole lot of demand for bank loans this year. Nate Tobik at Complete Bank Data says businesses have been hesitant to expand, and many that have got government aid.
And they were able to expand with that money, the grants from the government, versus needing credit from a bank.
Then there's people like you and me, people who got relief checks, student loan deferrals, and extra unemployment benefits. Bank analyst Gerard Cassidy at RBC Capital Markets says people have used that cash to pay off their credit card bills.
Because those are expensive balances, you know, the average yield tends to run around 12 to 14% with some interest rates as high as 25%.
This week, bank executives said borrowing could pick up again. People are spending more, and many government aid programs have come to an end. In the meantime, businesses are having trouble stocking their shelves, given the ongoing supply chain problems. If they ease up,
that will drive commercial loan demand as those inventories are rebuilt to normal levels.
Then there are housing loans. Peter Alden is president and CEO of Bay State Savings Bank in Massachusetts.
The volume is much higher than 2020, and we still have a quarter left to go.
Alden says demand for residential loans this year has remained strong. The bank's seeing more demand for home equity lines of credit and new mortgages.
A number of folks, because of escalated real estate values, have been selling their properties. So that's created opportunities for new lending relationships.
Alden says he'll be keeping an eye on delinquency rates as government aid programs end. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Now, here is a word I have not missed saying the past couple of years. Foreclosures. The number of properties in this economy in some stage of default reached a record low last year, thanks, of course, to the federal foreclosure moratorium we told you about a couple of times on this program. Also, some other protections for borrowers who couldn't pay their bills during the pandemic. But as those safeguards have expired, the numbers are going back up again. The property data firm Atom says foreclosures were up 34% in the third quarter, and more are likely coming, as Marketplace's Amy Scott reports.
There were more than 45,000 U.S. properties in some stage of foreclosure from July through September. That's up 68% from the same quarter a year ago. To put that number in perspective, though, Adams, Rick Sharga says in a more normal market,
we would be getting roughly three times that many loans in foreclosures.
Sharga says a foreclosure moratorium for federally backed mortgages and forbearance plans that let borrowers pause their payments have kept filings artificially low. But more and more borrowers have exhausted their maximum 18 months of forbearance, and the moratorium expired at the end of July.
Anybody who was in foreclosure before the foreclosure moratorium is now being put back into the foreclosure process. And there were about 250,000 of those loans before the pandemic hit.
Analysts are not expecting anything like the foreclosure crisis of the last recession. Mike Fratantoni is chief economist of the Mortgage Bankers Association. He says this time the job market is rapidly recovering and home prices are still rising.
So if a homeowner is unable to pick up their payments again and they're unable to qualify for modification, they honestly are going to be able to sell their home really very quickly and probably walk away with a substantial amount of cash in their pocket.
But selling still comes at a cost. James Burke is the home preservation coordinator with NCAL, a housing counseling agency in Delaware. He says it can take at least a year to rebuild credit after a serious delinquency.
So nobody's going to give them a new mortgage. And then all the rentals, there's not enough inventory for these homeowners. If they have to go to an apartment or a rental home, they're paying more than what they were paying when they owned the property.
Delaware had one of the highest foreclosure rates in the country last quarter, and Burke says he's gearing up for a lot more in the coming months. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Coming up,
things were really falling apart all over the mortgage market.
Better now, one hopes. First, though, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is up 382 points today, just over 1%, closed at 35,294, did the blue chips. The NASDAQ up 73 points, about a 0.5%, 14,897. S&P 500 up 33, 0.75%, 44.71. For the 5 days gone by, the Dow gained 1.5%, the NASDAQ up 2.2%, S&P 500 up 1.8%. Heard from Justin about that strong third quarter bank earnings season. Goldman Sachs, which earned $13.6 billion in revenue, rose 3.8% today. PNC Financial Services down 1.6%. Amy Scott was telling us about home foreclosures. Freddie Mac up 2.1%. Fannie Mae rose 2.2%. 10.14 billion is what the National Retail Federation predicts Americans are going to spend on Halloween this year. That exceeds pre-pandemic levels in some categories, including candy. Hershey, though, down 1.4%. Tootsie Roll Industries down 0.7%. Best Halloween candy, by the way. Don't at me on this one. Reese's Cups. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
And now a word from our sponsors at Betterment. Do you want your money to dream big? Do you want your money to be a total self-starter? Are you annoyed that your money doesn't work hard enough? Don't worry. Betterment is here to help. Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Their automated technology is built to help maximize returns. Meaning, when you invest with Betterment, your money can auto-adjust as you get closer to your goal. Rebalance if your portfolio gets too far out of line, and your dividends are automatically reinvested. That can increase the potential for compound returns. In other words, your money is breaking a sweat while you can be breaking bread. You'll never picture your money the same way again. Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. A guy by the name of Randall Quarles lost part of his job this week. For those of you who are saying, Randall who right now? Well, allow me. Mr. Quarles is a member of the Federal Reserve's Board of Governors, and as such, he of course participates in those big interest rate setting meetings we tell you about every 8 weeks or so. But Quarles and other board members have side hustles too. And Quarles has been, for the past 4 years, the Fed's vice chair for supervision, basically the central bank's top cop on banking. But the Fed announced this week Quarles' four-year term is going to be allowed to expire with no one replacing him. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer explains what's going on.
Usually there are seven Fed governors, including the chair and two vice chairs. They're appointed by the president and confirmed by the Senate, but the Board of Governors is supposed to be independent, apolitical. In fact,
it's actually set up a lot like many corporate boards.
Andrew Levin is a former Fed economist now teaching economics at Dartmouth College. How much power do the Fed governors have over the economy? Well, they do vote on interest rates, but...
The Fed chair is the CEO. The agenda, as I say, is set by the Fed chair.
Levin says when he was at the Fed, it was common knowledge that in the 90s, on Friday afternoons before big meetings to set interest rates, Chair Alan Greenspan would walk down the hall, stopping by each governor's office to tell them, okay, this is what we're going to do. Greenspan's successors, Ben Bernanke and Janet Yellen, were very different, says Scott Brown, chief economist of Raymond James, which is a current marketplace underwriter.
Both Bernanke and Yellen had this view that, you know, they don't know everything. Are willing to listen to other points of view. And really, the Fed tries to come to its monetary policy decisions by consensus.
Brown says it's still collegial under current chair Jerome Powell. Now, these governors specialize in certain areas like consumer affairs and community banking. Georgetown finance professor Rina Agarwal says the vice chair for supervision oversees banks and is responsible for
what happens during a crisis times and, what restrictions are put on dividend payments or repurchases of stock.
This is the position that's empty now. Agarwal says whoever President Biden chooses to fill it will focus on issues like economic inequality. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
The good people at Freddie Mac, the giant government-backed mortgage company, tell us that a 30-year fixed-rate mortgage can be had this week for 3.05% plus fees and points, of course. But my point in telling you that is to point out that mortgage rates are historically low right now, and that has let millions of homeowners refinance and thus reduce their mortgage payments, sometimes by a lot. But millions of other people who've arguably needed lower monthly costs more during the pandemic haven't been able to refi, as Marketplace's Samantha Fields explains.
When Emily Warner bought her house in Nashville in 2017, she had a job at a record label making almost six figures, and her partner was working too. So buying a house with a $2,100 a month mortgage at a 4.8 interest rate felt totally doable.
$2,100, sure, that's a big deal for anyone. But I felt like it was worth it.
Then came 2020. Warner got laid off, the pandemic hit, and she got divorced. Suddenly, that $2,100 a month mortgage payment felt like a lot more of a stretch. So when she started getting letters in the mail
saying that my rate would drop to 2.8%, it would drop my mortgage payment anywhere from $700 to $900. Which would make a huge difference every month for me.
But when Warner tried to refinance, she couldn't because she was unemployed. That is pretty much how it goes.
For the typical borrower, if you've become unemployed since you got your original mortgage, you're going to be pretty much locked out of the market.
Anthony DeFusco at the Kellogg School of Management at Northwestern University says that's long been true with conventional mortgages, like the one Warner has. But it wasn't always the case for people who had mortgages backed by the Federal Housing Administration, which are generally more popular with first-time and lower-income homebuyers because they require a smaller down payment.
It used to be that if you had an FHA mortgage and you became unemployed, you were allowed to refinance.
Then came late 2008-2009. After years of lenders getting more and more lax with credit and giving mortgages to people with basically no documentation at all,
things were really falling apart all over the mortgage market.
That, of course, led to the Great Recession. John Mondragon, a research advisor at the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco, says that's when the FHA changed the rules and started requiring people to show proof of employment to refinance. When that happened,
they really seemed to be pushing out those borrowers who were most likely to have demand for refinancing.
People who had lost their jobs in the recession. Technically, the FHA requirement that people be employed to refinance only lasted a couple of years, but most lenders have kept it in place ever since. Mondragon and DeFusco did a study looking at the impact of that change, and DeFusco says they found that back when homeowners didn't have to be employed to refinance,
unemployed people were refinancing at rates that were roughly, you know, in 2009, 3 to 5 times as large as the rate that employed people were refinancing.
Which means, he says, right now, there's likely a lot of pent-up demand from unemployed people. With refinancing off the table, a lot of low-income homeowners have been relying on the mortgage forbearance options the federal government put in place during the pandemic. Ivy Perez at the Center for New York City Neighborhoods says that's helped keep some out of foreclosure. But those forbearances are starting to run out, and people are looking for ways to keep their mortgages affordable longer term.
And being able to refinance for them obviously would also be a huge help for being able to afford their monthly mortgage payments.
It's something John Mondragon at the San Francisco Fed thinks should be on the table. There is risk in letting someone without a job refinance and giving them what is essentially a new loan. But Mondragon says because of the way the U.S. mortgage market is structured, where the vast majority of loans are insured,
that default risk is kind of already on the taxpayer books. And so we would just, you know, if we can get them into a lower rate, we're actually going to reduce the likelihood that they default.
Barring unemployed homeowners from refinancing doesn't just hurt them, he says. It also hurts the economy. Because when the Fed lowers interest rates in a recession,
part of the idea is that you lower interest rates, these interest rates get passed on to businesses so that they can invest and borrowers so that they can spend.
And one of the biggest channels for that, Mondragon says, is the mortgage market, because many people's mortgage payments are their biggest expense.
And so borrowers not being able to access low rates when they really should be and want to is stuff that makes recessions probably more painful than they need to be.
And he says it further exacerbates inequality, because people who have money and are financially stable are able to reduce their payments, while people who are struggling can't. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, in which, once again, I'm afraid I'm going to have to insist you consult your own financial professional. Bitcoin topped $62,000 today amid speculation. The Securities and Exchange Commission is set to approve a Bitcoin futures exchange-traded fund. That is, a fund that trades like a stock that's based on the future price of a little understood and highly speculative cryptocurrency. This one, I am reasonably certain about this, belongs in the what could possibly go wrong file. All right, we got to go, but here is your moment of economic context, global contagion edition. No, not the pandemic. You remember Evergrande, the Chinese real estate firm that caused all the agita a couple of weeks ago? Well, despite its having missed a couple of bond payments, the Chinese government says Evergrande's risks are, and this is their word, controllable. Feel better now? Yeah, I don't know. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Nancy Cassett is the managing director of news. Neil Scarborough is the vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you Monday, everybody. Have yourselves a great weekend, all right? This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.